Just a note that this session is being recorded and it will appear on the Bourne website as soon as we get all the technical stuff sorted out. So I think we will begin, seeing as it's noon. More people will join, I'm sure. So good afternoon. My name is Anne Sprague, and I'm a project advisor with Bourne Ontario, and I'm welcoming you on behalf of Bourne Ontario to the webinar focusing on evidence about and real-world experience with COVID-19 vaccination and pregnancy. The chat box at the bottom of your screen is enabled for questions, and the questions will be answered at the end by our presenters, and our moderator will help with that. To begin, I'm going to do a short land acknowledgement. So I would like to begin by acknowledging that the land on which Bourne Ontario is situated is the traditional unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people, whose presence and culture reaches back to time immemorial. We take this time to show our gratitude and respect to them and to the land for all that it provides. Also, as Ottawa is a gathering place for many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis from across Turtle Island, we support community efforts to strengthen our relationships with Indigenous peoples based on the principles of respect, dignity, trust, and cooperation. So right now I will move along and introduce you to our moderator today, who is Dr. Doreen Elchar. Doreen is a maternal fetal medicine specialist at the Ottawa Hospital and a faculty member at the University of Ottawa. And she's also a COVID-19 researcher and head of the COPE Network, which is COVID-19 Ontario Pregnancy Events, looking at COVID transmission to newborns from women who are COVID positive. So Doreen, I'll pass it over to you to introduce our speakers and to moderate the session. Thank you for joining us, everybody.
Thanks, Anne, and always a pleasure to be with in the presence of two of my favorite COVID-19 and vaccine cohort colleagues. So I'm excited to present both of them. As explained, I'll present both, and they'll both go back to back with presentations. And if there's any questions, we'll take them all at the end. I'll moderate the chat if people want to put them in so they don't forget. That's fine as well. And we can review. So our first presenter today is Dr. Deshane Fell, who's an associate professor at the School of Epidemiology and Public Health at the University of Ottawa. She's also a scientist at the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario Research Institute and at Bourne, Ontario. And her research interest, as all of you may know, has been focused on vaccine and pregnancy. So not just the COVID vaccine, but many previous vaccines that are instrumental and that we use in our regular practice. She's also an adjunct scientist at ICES. Dr. Tally Bogler is an academic family physician and family medicine obstetrics provider at St. Michael's Hospital Unity Health Network in Toronto. She's also an assistant professor at the University of Toronto and also appointed at the Dalai Lama School of Public Health as well. She's been keeping very busy. She's the chair of the Family Medicine Obstetrics at St. Michael's Hospital. But I think more importantly, what I think you've provided to our community during the last 2 years is a fantastic Instagram page called Pandemic Pregnancy Guide that's really been valuable, you know, for healthcare provider, patients, for lots of questions and parents. So I know that some of us have used it regularly, and we're really grateful that you're able to get that going for the province. So with that, I'll leave our presenters to take the lead. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the introduction, and good morning, everyone. So I'm going to begin the seminar with some background information about what the evidence so far is showing us about COVID-19 vaccination during pregnancy, and also show you the data that we've been working with here in Ontario. So to give you kind of to set the stage, and then hand it over to Dr. Bogler, who will talk a lot about some of the questions that come up in kind of real world practice. So before I begin, I have no conflicts of interest to declare, and these are my disclosures. So when new vaccines are developed, they're rigorously tested for both safety and efficacy through a series of randomized clinical trials. But as we've seen in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, when a vaccine is developed for general use in the whole population, they typically exclude many important special subpopulations, such as pregnant people, which is what we saw happen with the initial vaccine licensure trials for COVID-19. But there actually are a lot of randomized clinical trials that have been done for vaccines specifically in the pregnant population, for example, for influenza. And there are other vaccines that are under development that are tested through an RCT process with pregnant people. But even within those trials, when they do specifically include pregnant people, they tend to be small in size relative to some of the real world studies that we can do, which then limits the power they have to evaluate, to robustly evaluate some of the more rare potential adverse outcomes of pregnancy. So something like stillbirth, for instance. And they also tend to recruit people in the later second trimester and third trimester of pregnancy, which means that then if a vaccine is used, earlier in pregnancy or in the first trimester in the real world, again, we don't typically get data from trials on that. And so it really speaks to the importance of real world studies using data sources such as the Born Registry, and I'll get to that in a few minutes, to conduct ongoing assessment both of safety as well as effectiveness of vaccines when they're used in pregnant people. Of course, we know from this pandemic that COVID-19 illness in pregnancy is associated with a number of adverse outcomes, both for pregnant people themselves, as well as some increased risks of adverse pregnancy outcomes. There are many studies internationally, and we now have some published Canadian data that was published just a few weeks ago in JAMA, showing an increased risk of ICU admission of pregnant people, death in some settings, and other adverse outcomes with COVID-19 during pregnancy. Particularly during the Delta wave. And then a number of studies, again, from around the world have documented increased risk of adverse outcomes of pregnancy, including things like preterm birth and stillbirth. So for all of these reasons, we recommend in Canada and many other countries, COVID-19 vaccination for pregnant people. And of course, here in Canada, as in probably most other countries, we went through a very rapid evolution, I guess, of recommendations for COVID-19 vaccination during pregnancy between December 2020, when the vaccines first became available, up until the late spring last year, so the end of May of last year. But essentially, we started in a place where the vaccines were not routinely recommended for pregnant people. And then it was shortly thereafter relaxed that to say that pregnant people may be offered vaccination if they were otherwise eligible through being part of another priority group, such as healthcare workers or other frontline workers. But by the end of April here in Ontario, pregnant people were prioritized in the province's vaccination program. Around the world, many countries now also recommend COVID-19 vaccination in pregnancy. And I just pulled this update this morning. As of today, there are 196 countries or territories that have some sort of a policy about COVID-19 vaccination in pregnancy. Very few don't recommend it at all, as you can see. 56% of these countries recommend vaccination for some or all pregnant people. And then another 30% recommend or permit vaccination of pregnant people, again, probably because they belong to other high-risk priority groups in countries that are still implementing their initial vaccination program. So before I start to get into safety information and then show you the Ontario data, I'll just make a couple of brief comments about a few other things that we know that are important about COVID-19 vaccination during pregnancy. So first of all, we know that when a COVID-19 vaccine is administered in a pregnant person, it induces antibody responses or immune responses that are very similar to non-pregnant people of similar age. We know that the antibody titers are actually higher following vaccination and pregnancy compared with COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 infection during pregnancy. And we also know that the maternal antibodies are present in the umbilical cord blood at the time of birth and also in breast milk samples. When we think about local and systemic reactions, or what we call reactogenicity, it's also very similar in pregnant people compared with non-pregnant people. A couple of large US studies have reported quite extensively on these types of symptoms following administration of COVID-19 vaccination during pregnancy, and found while injection site pain was more commonly reported by pregnant people, other symptoms like headache, muscle soreness, chills, and fever were actually reported less frequently in that population compared to other general populations. And then finally, another really important question that we always ask when we think about vaccination in pregnancy is it as effective when administered in pregnancy compared with non-pregnant people? And so there's a couple of studies now that have been published showing that clinically, the level of vaccine effectiveness that we see when a pregnant person is immunized with COVID-19 vaccine is very similar to the type of protection that we see in general populations. And importantly, there are now a couple of studies that have also shown that COVID-19 vaccination during pregnancy reduces the risk of COVID-19 infection and COVID-19 hospitalization among infants less than 6 months of age, which is really important and actually completely in agreement with well-known benefits of influenza vaccination in pregnancy and pertussis vaccination during pregnancy. So let's move on to just a little bit of quick background information on some safety studies that have been published from around the world, and then I'll jump into the Ontario data. Just to begin with, there were a couple of studies that quite early on, back last winter, I guess, were able to conduct very robust assessments of risk of miscarriage following vaccination in pregnancy. This first study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine using Norwegian registry data. And they conducted a case control study using these data and basically identified cases of miscarriage and compared those cases with ongoing pregnancies in the same time period, and then looked back within a 5-week window to see what proportion of cases and what proportion of the ongoing pregnancies or the controls had received a COVID-19 vaccine in that interval. And basically, you can see that in that 5-week period, about 5.1% of cases and 5.5% of controls had received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine. And when they formally compared these two groups and adjusted for a number of factors that might have been different between these two groups, like their age, for example, or other characteristics, they didn't find any evidence of any increased risk of miscarriage. And they also looked within a 3-week exposure window as well. And similarly, these are the adjusted odds ratios here, didn't find any indication of increased risk. At almost the same time, a very similar design study was published from the United States, from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control Vaccine Safety Data Link, which is a really robust and longstanding platform that's been used for many years to evaluate safety of vaccination in general in pregnancy. So similarly, they did a case control study as well using the VSD data and sort of did a similar thing where they identified cases of miscarriage before 20 weeks gestation and compared the odds of having been vaccinated in the 4-week window up to that point between the cases and then ongoing pregnancies. And very similarly, here's their overall adjusted odds ratio indicating no increased risk of spontaneous abortion or miscarriage following COVID-19 vaccination in pregnancy. And importantly, they didn't find any difference as well when they looked at the gestational age of when the miscarriage occurred and also by the mRNA vaccine product type. So they stratified by Moderna and Pfizer. And I should say that the Norwegian study also did that and didn't find any difference according to the type of vaccine or the number of doses that were received in that window. Another safety study from the Vaccine Safety Data Link, once again, this was a different type of a study called a cohort study, where they evaluated risk of preterm birth and small for gestational age birth in a fairly large number of pregnant people or births, actually 46,079 total births were included in this study. And in that particular time period, 22% approximately of people had been vaccinated, had received at least one dose during the pregnancy. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through this table, which is a bit busy, but essentially, here's just looking at the prevalence of preterm birth. So they found a prevalence of 7% in those who hadn't received any doses of COVID-19 vaccine and a slightly lower percent preterm birth in those who had received vaccination. When they again took into account differences between these groups like age and parity and other potentially confounding factors, they didn't find any indication of increased risk. So their adjusted hazard ratio was 0.91, which is less than one. And the confidence interval included the null value. This means it wasn't statistically significant. And basically similarly for small for gestational age, no indication of any increased risk in this large study. Another large study was quite recently published. This was using data from not only the Norwegian Birth Registry, but also the Swedish Registry. So these are really robust countrywide registries in Scandinavia. There were 150,000 births in this particular study, where they looked at similar outcomes, preterm birth and SGA birth, but they also looked at, importantly, at stillbirth, low APGAR score in the low 5-minute APGAR score in the newborns and NICU admission. And very briefly, again, you can see from all of these estimates, which are adjusted for many different factors, they were all below one, and all of them had confidence intervals, including the null value. So this indicates no increased risk of any of these outcomes in this very large population. There are a few other studies that are smaller, but I'm going to, in the interest of time, move on to presenting the Ontario data that we have so far to you. So just very briefly, last year at this time, I think we, a large group of us, received funds from the Vaccine Surveillance Reference Group within the COVID-19 Immunity Task Force, which is part of the Public Health Agency of Canada, to conduct assessment of COVID-19 vaccination in pregnancy in Ontario. So we had three objectives, and I'm going to briefly present some data relating to the first objective, which was really to focus on safety, and the third objective, which is looking at coverage in the pregnant population in Ontario. So to do this, we're using the Born Ontario Birth Registry, which probably many of you contribute to and know a lot about. So I'm not going to describe the registry in much detail. But as you know, since 2012, the Born Registry has collected information on all live births and stillbirths from all hospitals that deliver across the province, as well as midwifery practice groups and birthing centers. There are other sorts of data that enter the system as well, including information from all prenatal screening visits and other types of visits. And I just put an asterisk beside the first two sources of data, because these are the records that we're using kind of in real time, really, to do these studies. So essentially, on up until recently, we were doing this on a monthly basis. We're now doing it a bit less frequently now that the intense part of the vaccination program is kind of behind us, at least for the moment. So we're on a regular basis extracting all the prenatal screening records in the registry, which is how we can identify people who are currently pregnant, the ongoing pregnancies, and then also all of the birth records for the completed pregnancies. And then on a monthly basis, we Born Ontario and the study team receives an extract of data from the Ministry of Health from the COVAXON database, which is where all of the immunization events are collated across the province, regardless of the setting. So we receive the records for all females 15 to 45 years of age, and then also receive information about COVID-19 infection in all females 15 to 45. And we're able to then link these records to the birth registry to identify people who either had COVID-19 illness or disease or COVID-19 vaccination during their pregnancy and when it occurred. So we've completed three studies. I'm going to just show you a few findings from each of them. The first one is published so far. This was published in March in JAMA. And then we have two other studies that are currently under review that I'll show you data for. So the first one, because it was quite early in the rollout of the vaccine program, most of the births that we could identify at that point in time, the people had been vaccinated in the later part of pregnancy. So third trimester predominantly, and a bit in the late second trimester. And so in this first study, we looked at peripartum outcomes, so outcomes that occur really right around the time of the delivery itself. So in this study, we looked at postpartum hemorrhage, chorioamnionitis, cesarean delivery in the mothers, and then NICU admission and 5-minute APGAR scores in the newborns. This was a cohort study design, and we compared people who had received at least one dose of vaccination in the pregnancy, so between the estimated date of conception up to the delivery, and we compared them with two different unvaccinated groups. The first were people who eventually got vaccinated, but not until after their pregnancy, and that had largely to do with where their pregnancy was in calendar time and the way that the eligibility for vaccination in pregnant people rolled out in the province. And then we had a second comparison group of people who were never vaccinated at any point before, during, or after the pregnancy. at that point in time. I'm not going to go into detail here on the methodology, but I did just want to mention that because we're using the birth registry, we're fortunate to have a lot of really good kind of baseline information available that we can use to adjust for potential confounding, which is really important in these types of studies. So all of our models adjust for things like maternal age, BMI, smoking, socioeconomic status, maternal health conditions, and other factors that you can see listed there. And there are a number of subgroup analyses that we did as well, looking according to the type of vaccine product, which is limited to the mRNA products because we didn't use a lot of AstraZeneca or other vaccines in pregnant people in the province. We looked also by number of doses and the timing, the pregnancy timing of dose one. So in this first study, there were a little more than 97,000 people who were included. And at that moment in time, 23% of those individuals had received at least one dose of vaccine in pregnancy. And then this is just to show you the size of the two comparison groups. So 44,815 who were vaccinated, but not until after the pregnancy. So they were not vaccinated in pregnancy. And then 30,115 who hadn't received any vaccine at that point. This just shows you the gestational timing and gets at the comment I made a few minutes ago that at that moment in time, which was a number of months ago now, when we look at the vaccinated people, we're predominantly looking at third trimester and late second trimester timing of vaccination. Now we're able to, of course, look at earlier pregnancy timing as well. But at that moment, that was all that we had available. I just wanted to note how different these comparison groups are, at least in this particular study. So if we just look at age, for instance, the people who were vaccinated during the pregnancy, if we look, for instance, at the proportion who were less than 25 years of age when they gave birth, only 4% were under 25, whereas in the group of people vaccinated after pregnancy, this was about 7%, and then the never vaccinated was 14%. So quite a different distribution of age in the vaccinated group compared with the two comparison groups. Similar, the percent smokers in the groups was quite different. And if we look at neighborhood income quintile, which is just a measure of socioeconomic status, if we look, for instance, at the proportion in the lowest quintile, we can see about 15% in the vaccinated group, about 19% in those vaccinated later after the pregnancy, and more than a quarter or about a quarter in those who were never vaccinated. So really different distributions, which is why it's so important to be able to adjust for all of these factors. Jumping very quickly to the results, this table from the manuscript is showing the comparison between the vaccinated individuals and the people vaccinated after pregnancy. And so essentially what you can see when we look in this first box at the outcomes in the pregnant people themselves, if we look at postpartum hemorrhage, the frequency was very similar in the vaccinated and vaccinated after pregnancy group, similar with chorioamnionitis, cesarean delivery and emergency cesarean delivery. And then even after we adjusted for all of those factors that I mentioned, we don't see any indication of an increased risk of any of these outcomes. And that's kind of what this figure over here is just quickly summarizing for you, because it's a bit easier to look at than all of the numbers. Basically, this line, this vertical line in the middle is one. Anything to the left of that indicates lower risk in the vaccinated group, and anything to the right would indicate higher risk. And you can see none of these point estimates are over in this side. So there's no indication of any increased risk. And similarly for the newborn outcomes as well, no indication of any increased risk. I won't go through the comparison with the other comparison group is actually virtually the same, so I'm not presenting it here. So just to summarize from this first study, we didn't see any association between vaccination and any of the outcomes that we looked at that time. We also didn't see any differences when we compared, when we looked at people who'd received Pfizer vaccine versus Moderna vaccine, whether they had received their first dose in the first, second trimester or the third trimester, and whether they'd received one or both doses during the pregnancy. So I'm going to move quickly on to the next study, which is kind of a similar type of study design, but it was conducted later in time. And here we were able to look at some other very important outcomes, preterm birth, small for gestational age birth, and stillbirth. Otherwise, the design is fairly similar, although here we're just comparing individuals who were vaccinated during pregnancy with those who were not vaccinated at all during the pregnancy. And for this type of a study, particularly for preterm birth, I'm not going to go into the details here, but it requires kind of a more sophisticated approach for determining when the timing of the vaccination occurred during the pregnancy with respect to the follow-up that we have available. And so we had to use this approach using something called a time-varying exposure, and I won't go into the details. Again, I'm also not going to go into the details here, but just to emphasize once again that we, through the registry, have a lot of very rich information on kind of baseline characteristics of individuals, which allows us to do a careful adjustment of the comparisons that we make. And similarly, we were able to do several subgroup analyses here as well. So in this time period, which is a slightly different window of time that we used, we were looking at 72,249 births. In this time period, almost 50% actually were born to vaccinated people. And when we look at the number of doses, this is among those vaccinated, about 64% had received two doses and 80% had received Pfizer, and basically 20% had received Moderna. The percent who had received anything other than those two products was about 1%, or possibly, I think, even less than 1% actually. So we can't look at that specifically. And this is just to show the timing again. When we look at people who only had one dose in pregnancy, kind of a more of a similar distribution to what we saw in the other study. These are people whose pregnancies were later in time. And so they had enough time to get one dose at the end of their pregnancy. And most of these people do ultimately go on to get a dose, a second dose after pregnancy. And these are the people who had two doses during the pregnancy. And so you can see we have a much better distribution here of people who've received vaccine earlier in the second trimester and even into the first trimester at this point in time. And so just moving very quickly to the results, first of all, for preterm birth. So we have here in this column, people who were not vaccinated during pregnancy, and on the right-hand column, those who were vaccinated. In the first row, we're just showing the percent of infants that were born preterm. So 7% in the unvaccinated group, 6.5% in the vaccinated group. When we use the models that we're using with a time-varying exposure and adjusting for all the variables that I mentioned earlier, you can see that our adjusted hazard ratio is below one, so 0.97, with a confidence interval that includes one, meaning not statistically significant. So no indication of increased risk. Basically the same for small for gestational age birth, very similar incidences of SGA in the two groups, and following adjustment, no significant difference between the groups. And then finally, similarly with stillbirth, of course, the numbers are much smaller, but there's no increased risk of stillbirth as well. In fact, it's to the left of one, so it looks a little bit protective, but it is not statistically significant. So just to summarize from this study, again, no increased risk of any of the outcomes that we evaluated in this time window. When we broke it down by the type of vaccine they received, the timing of the first dose, and also the number of doses that they received, we didn't see any differences. And similarly with the sensitivity analyses that we've done. And this paper is currently under revision with a journal, so I'm hoping it'll be available fairly soon. And finally, just to wrap up before I hand it over to Dr. Bogler, I'll just say a few words about coverage in the province. So when we look at all the people who were pregnant at any point between mid-December 2020 up to the end of December 2021, so over 200,000, 81,104 had received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine while pregnant. And now we're starting to see many more pregnant people who've actually been vaccinated before their pregnancy and therefore are protected during the pregnancy. So that number is increasing more and more each time we extract a more updated data set. When we look within each month, what we did was estimate the number of people who were pregnant in each of these months, and then looked at what proportion were vaccinated and with how many doses. And so you can see how dramatically things changed in April, May, when pregnant people became eligible for COVID-19 vaccination. We saw huge increases initially, and then just kind of a slow and steady increase over time. In December 2021, 71% of people we estimate had received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, either before or during pregnancy, and therefore were protected in pregnancy. And what you can see in the gray at the top of this stacked bar is the proportion who were receiving a third dose, actually. So that number increases even more in the more recent months. This is just a heat map to kind of show how it all played out over time. What's interesting is you can see a small but distinct initial cluster of vaccines that were given during pregnancy back in January 2021. So these were likely many of our healthcare workers or other frontline workers who were eligible at that point in time. But essentially in late April and into May is when pregnancy was prioritized, and that's where you can see most of the activity happening. If you can see the faint dotted lines going across, you'll see that the lower part of the plot down here is actually doses given in the first trimester, and in the mid part is second trimester, and the top is third trimester. Over here at the far right, you can see the third doses coming on board. That's what these are lighting up here. And this is just showing among the completed pregnancies. So these are the ones that we can evaluate right now because we have a birth record. So we can actually look at outcomes in this group. And you can see that we're starting now to see these first trimester vaccinations. We had to wait a while, obviously, for those babies to be born before we could start to look at those outcomes. And we'll still have to wait a little while before we can start to look at outcomes following third dose in pregnancy. There's really quite stark differences in characteristics of people who have received vaccination during pregnancy in that first year of the program between December 2020 and 2021. In particular, we saw lower initiation of vaccination in pregnancy in individuals with lower age. Those who smoked in pregnancy had lower uptake or initiation of vaccination in pregnancy in rural areas, lower neighborhood income settings, and individuals living in neighborhoods with higher material deprivation. All of these groups had lower initiation of vaccination. We did see higher vaccine initiation among pregnant people that had chronic medical conditions, which is good. Not as striking perhaps as I might have expected to see based on what we used to see with influenza, but nevertheless, a slightly higher uptake in people with chronic conditions. So just to summarize, the safety evidence to date that we've seen internationally is very reassuring. And what we're seeing here in the Ontario data is concordant with what we've seen now in other large published studies from the United States, Israel, and Scandinavian countries. And obviously there are more and more studies being published all the time. There obviously are still some evidence gaps, including outcomes after first trimester exposure. We still need some robust studies to be done looking at congenital anomalies, looking at longer term outcomes of infants. But there are some data now actually that I didn't have time to go into today, not finding any increased risk in babies in the first 6 months. Booster doses, that's obviously fairly new, so we still need to do some research on that. And a particular gap which we're not going to be able to solve with the Ontario data is outcomes following non-mRNA vaccines, because we're really not using those vaccines in pregnant people, but in many countries around the world, they are using other products. And so that's a particularly important gap. I just wanted to acknowledge the funding source, the COVID-19 Immunity Task Force, and also the Ontario Ministry of Health for providing access to the COVAX database, and also to many of you who probably work in our province's hospitals taking care of pregnant patients and their babies. The hospitals have been incredible about entering their data on a timely basis, which allows us to conduct these studies. And then finally, Born Ontario staff for their huge assistance with all of this work, and the study investigators. And I wanted to make a particular shout out to my analytical team. This group of individuals have been incredible and working really hard to do these very complex studies in a short time period. So thank you very much. And over to you, Dr. Bogler.
That's great. I might make a quick comment. I know we left questions, but I thought there was one question that came directly to Carolina. I'll quickly as Dr. Bogler Loser slides. So that slide that showed how the data was obtained explained some of the questions, because people were wondering, oh, I'm not inputting if my patients were vaccinated into the Born records that I'm putting up, because they are nicely filling out every record on their patients. And then when they ask their patients about it in clinic, they haven't been asked particularly when they're getting a vaccine. So I just wanted to clarify that, if it's okay, Deshane, I can fill in quickly that we have the COVAX data is coming to Born, and then they figure out who received it while they were pregnant based on the data set link that they receive. And that's how they know when and where and how many doses were received. So just to answer that question, we're not relying on that coming in from the usual way. So hope that clarifies.
Okay, I guess I'll begin. So hi, everyone. Thanks for that excellent presentation, Dr. Fell. I'm just going to get started. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. And my goal for the next 20 minutes or so is just to answer some of the common questions in the perinatal population around COVID-19 vaccines. These common questions are primarily from Pandemic Pregnancy Guide, which really was a social media account that was created at the beginning of the pandemic just to answer questions that people had. And then once vaccines became available back in January 2021, it really became this knowledge translation platform, sharing evidence-based information, particularly around the COVID-19 vaccine. So we were getting hundreds and hundreds of messages from our followers because the account grew over those months to over 43,000 followers from across Canada. So I'm just going over the most common questions that we still receive, some of the questions that I received from my own patients, and also from the SickKids consult vaccine line, which actually expanded to the perinatal population. If I have time, I'll share some of the key resources that I use with my patients, and then hopefully we have time for questions at the end. This is Pandemic Pregnancy Guide. Feel free to check it out or share with your patients or with other providers. So the number one question still to this day is, but what about the lack of long-term data? And this was a Q&A that I did with today's parent about some of the common questions. And my answer to them was, you know, usually patients have no specific ideas about what could happen down the road, but they're just worried that something could happen. And I like to just tell people when I'm doing a presentation, like, what typically is my go-to answer? And because some people say, but I just want the language, I just want to know what to say, or I need an approach. And so this is my approach. And I usually answer this by first saying, you know, of course we want more data rather than less, and explaining a little bit about mRNA vaccines. So we know, you know, mRNA vaccines have been studied in humans since 2013 with no known long-term effects. What we know about the mRNA vaccine, it gets broken down in the body in 2 to 3 days, and the protein may stay up in the body for up to 2 to 3 weeks. So any potential side effects tend to happen in those first 6 weeks. We also, and this is very important for the pregnant population, and this is very reassuring for patients usually, is that we have studies now demonstrated that the mRNA vaccine itself does not cross the placenta. And it's only the maternal antibodies that cross the placenta, which actually can be protective for the baby. So that's a really important point. And when my patients ask me about long-term implications on the baby, I remind them to think about the long-term health implications associated with preterm birth, for which the risk doubles if you're unvaccinated and contract COVID-19 in pregnancy. And so just to think about that, and I really get them to think about it. And we have excellent long-term data from other vaccines that we routinely give in pregnancy, like the flu vaccine and the whooping cough vaccine. Both of those studies, were conducted by Dr. Deshane Fell, but those children, you know, were followed for the first 3 to 6 years of life, and there were no adverse health outcomes in those children. And so that's very reassuring for patients too, to know that there are other routine vaccines that we give in pregnancy, and we have long-term data. And, you know, tied to this is just, but, you know, it's new, right? We don't have long-term data. We don't have enough data on this vaccine. And what I typically tell patients is, you know, we're not at the same point as we were back in January 2021. So at this point, we have a lot of safety data. So more than 213,000 pregnant individuals have been vaccinated in the US and over 100,000 in the UK. And there are no safety concerns appearing in reporting. There are now 21 large studies from 5 different countries, including Bourne, Ontario, that Dr. Fell just went through, with a total of, you know, over 200,000 people vaccinated in pregnancy in those studies altogether combined, which have found no increased risk of miscarriage, preterm birth, stillbirth, small for gestational age, or congenital abnormalities, no increased risk of NICU admission, and again, no health problems in the babies in the first few months of life, which is also very reassuring. On the other hand, COVID-19 infection in pregnancy is associated with adverse maternal and pregnancy outcomes, including increasing for hospitalization, ICU admission, stillbirth and preterm birth, as well as preeclampsia and neonatal death. So the bottom line is the COVID-19 vaccine is safe in pregnancy, but COVID-19 infection is not. And if you're not if you're on Twitter and you're not following Vicky Mail, I suggest that you do, because she has this wonderful up-to-date list of all the studies, and she's constantly reporting on various studies that are coming out on COVID-19 vaccine. And this is one of her infographics that I think is just excellent and summarizes things so well. The other one, just add to the list of, you know, is COVID-19 vaccine safe in pregnancy? There is a more recent study that actually showed a reduction, a 15% reduction in stillbirth. So not only is it, you know, there's no increased risk of stillbirth, but actually there's studies now showing a 15% reduction in stillbirth. And that's based on a systematic review and meta-analysis. The next question that always comes up is, what about the first trimester? People are often a little bit hands-off in first trimester, especially for patients who have had difficulty conceiving. Maybe they underwent IVF or have had miscarriages in the past, and they just don't want to do anything in first trimester. And I get that anxiety and that concern with my patients. And so it's true, as Dr. Fell was alluding to, you know, we don't have that much data on first trimester. Hopefully we will get more data in the next, you know, few months as those babies are now being born. But what we do have is a few studies. So there's one subgroup analysis that showed essentially no difference in health outcomes in those who were vaccinated in first trimester. And this one particularly interesting study that I really liked, it's a retrospective cohort study. And they looked at anatomy ultrasounds done at 20 weeks and looked at those who were vaccinated early in pregnancy, so before 14 weeks and a little bit after. And there was no difference in congenital anomalies between the two groups. So that's very reassuring data in terms of first trimester specifically as well. Of course, more data is needed. And then the other question about first trimester is just the increased risk of miscarriage. You know, could there be an increased risk? And at this point now, we have excellent studies, two registry studies and two case control studies that Dr. Fell reviewed as well that showed no increased risk of miscarriage when vaccines are given early on in pregnancy. The next question we always get now, well, so if there's a protection to the baby, you know, is there an ideal time? Should I wait until my second or third trimester to get the vaccine? And people are reading studies, people are staying up to date. And so, you know, they see certain studies and they say, well, maybe I should wait. And, you know, the answer that I give to my patients, really the best time to get your vaccine or booster now, which is often the discussion, is now, regardless of gestation. So the best way to protect your pregnancy and the fetus, given adverse outcomes associated with COVID-19 infection in pregnancy, including preterm birth, is getting the vaccine right when you're eligible or that booster. And we have studies that have found that pregnant individuals who are vaccinated, you know, transmit antibodies to their newborns regardless of the timing of their vaccine, whether it's in first, second, or third trimester, even 6 weeks prior to pregnancy. It is true that the highest amount found in the cord blood is when it's given at the late second, early third trimester. And, you know, this other study that I usually talk about in my answer is how the booster dose specifically, as we're trying to encourage people to get the booster dose, highest levels of antibodies were found in the umbilical cord in individuals who received their booster dose. I'll skip that. The next question we always get, well, how do we know how long the antibodies last in my baby? Like, how much protection am I going to be giving to the baby, and how long should I feel, you know, reassured that they're getting some protection? And this particular study published in JAMA found that at 6 months of life, almost 60% of the infants born to vaccinated mothers had detectable antibodies at 6 months, and 8% of the infants born 8% of babies who were born to infected mothers who had COVID-19 infection had antibodies. So just showing that obviously the vaccine is way more protective than COVID-19 infection itself for the babies. These mothers received the vaccine around 20 to 32 weeks. And not only do we know that those antibodies last, but we actually understand now that it likely confers protection. And this data was showing that having received two doses of COVID-19 vaccine in pregnancy was associated with a decreased risk of hospitalization in babies less than 6 months after birth. So it reduced risk of hospitalization by 60% if the mother received vaccine anytime in pregnancy, a little bit higher, obviously, if it was after 20 weeks, it was an 80% reduction in hospitalization. So not only do we know that antibodies last about maybe 3 to 6 months in the newborns, but also that it confers actual protection against hospitalization. And that's really important. And it's something that we predicted, given what we know about the whooping cough vaccine Adacel pertussis and the flu vaccine as well. So we imagined and predicted that this would be beneficial and protective for babies once they were born. Some people are worried, you know, I have a lot of patients who worry, isn't the booster dose sort of overdoing it? And I explain, you know, how immunity wanes over time. There's no cumulative effect of the vaccine. This is why we often see multiple dose vaccine series routinely in children, teenagers, as well as adults. And we have some data, although, you know, the booster doses are new, we have some data that has come out that shows the booster dose, you know, is effective in the pregnant population, even against Omicron. And people have questions about Omicron. Again, the data, you know, where Omicron is still relatively new in the scheme of things throughout, you know, when we compare the whole pandemic, but hopefully we are gathering data, and data should be coming out now on Omicron specific information. And I know on a Canadian level, that data is being pulled. What if I already had COVID? Do I need to get the vaccine? This is a very common question. And yes, you do need to get the vaccine. It's strongly recommended even after COVID-19 infection, because we know that it's stronger and longer lasting protection, and typically recommend 8 weeks after a COVID infection to get dose one or dose two of the COVID vaccine. And typically recommend three months after a COVID infection to get a booster dose. I don't know how much time I have, but another question that always comes up on Pandemic Pregnancy Guide and with so many of my patients still, even time after time, after we try to debunk this myth, is, you know, the concerns about infertility. And this is one of the first myths that we heard on the topic of vaccines and reproductive health. And, you know, the valid concerns around vaccines and pregnancy, given that the initial trials, you know, excluded pregnant and breastfeeding individuals, was sort of eclipsed by targeted misinformation campaigns led by vaccine skeptics and anti-vaxxers, who essentially weaponized women's health issues to advance their agenda, which isn't new when it comes to vaccines and fertility. And there was this myth floating around the internet back in January 2021, and it was put out by a scientist who was the former head of respiratory research for Pfizer, claiming that the spike protein on COVID-19, or also encoded for by the COVID-19 vaccine, shared genetic similarities or homology to syncytin-1, which is an important protein for placental development. And the claim assumed that there could be cross-reactivity between antibodies that attack the spike protein could then also attack syncytin-1 and damage the placenta. And so this was one of the very first myths that we heard. And right away on Pandemic Pregnancy Guide, we did a video with a geneticist basically debunking that myth and showing how unlikely it was given the limited homology between the SARS-CoV-2 protein and syncytin-1. And if it was true that there was some homology, we would see or the vaccine seen. And now we have very good studies to show that that's really not the case. And so since this initial video, we have lots of excellent studies and data disproving this myth. To further answer this specific question about cross-reactivity, this study was published back in October and actually looked at plasma levels of those vaccinated or infected with COVID-19 to see if there was any cross-reactivity between anti-SARS-CoV-2 spike protein antibodies with syncytin-1, and no cross-reactivity was found. And if there was any cross-reactivity, you know, we would assume that there would be issues with embryo implantation. And this study looked at IVF with frozen embryo transfers, and there was no difference in implantation or early pregnancy development in those patients with or without IgG antibodies. And there have been multiple other IVF studies that have found no difference in ovarian function, IVF parameters, IVF success performance after getting the vaccine. And I will say that, you know, in terms of male fertility, vaccination does not make any difference to sperm count or quality, but it is worth noting that a number of studies have found that COVID-19 infection itself does reduce sperm quality. I really like this particular prospective cohort study. It was of over 2,000 females in the US and Canada who were trying to conceive without fertility treatment, and they found no association between female and male partner fertility following COVID-19 vaccination, no association between female fertility following COVID-19 infection, but there was a short-term, less than 60-day delay association between male partner fertility following COVID-19 infection. I think I'm out of time, and I'll leave this if there's any questions about menstrual irregularities, but this is another one that has come up a lot and people continue to ask.
I'm jumping on to say, like, we're about 10 minutes, so we can maybe see if there's any questions, but if there was any slides that you wanted to go through, I think there's...
We can take any questions, or I can talk about menstrual irregularities if you want.
We can't hear you, Doreen. Doreen? We still can't hear you, Doreen. But Tali, I just saw a question come in, so maybe I'll just take over till Doreen's AirPods kick in, asking, could you speak to the menstrual irregularity?
Yeah, I can share those slides that I had. Tara looks confused. I'll share them quickly. So menstrual irregularities. There were many anecdotal reports that surfaced online of people noticing changes to their menstrual cycle following COVID-19 vaccination. And in Canada, we don't actively collect this data, which I personally think is an issue. In other places in the world, like in the UK, they do collect this data. And there was a small proportion of women who were noticing changes to their menstrual cycles. Most of those reports were short-lived. And it is important to note that COVID-19 infection itself can impact the menstrual cycle. Some plausible mechanisms that were put forth were that the uterine lining is part of the immune system, or that there's potential temporary disruption to the HPA axis. Here, I'll just share my next slide. At first we didn't really have any good evidence to say one way or the other. This was sort of just anecdotal reports that were, surfacing online. At this point, we have a few studies actually. So there's one UK-based preprint study. I think it might be published at this point, but it did not find any association between the COVID-19 vaccine and menstrual changes. There was some preliminary data from a Norwegian cohort retrospective that found women did report heavier periods than normal after the first and second vaccine dose, but most were transient, and there was a high incidence of menstrual changes in the cycle even before getting vaccinated. Then there was a report you might have seen in the news a few months ago that there was a study that found some effect on menstrual cycle length. And I think the media, picked that up and reported it. But I think it's important to review the study to note that, first of all, this was a US prospective study, which is good. Prospective is, definitely higher quality evidence when it comes to menstrual changes specifically, because it's, as you can, I can imagine, it's hard to remember menstrual changes retrospectively. And so this was a US prospective study with 4,000 participants who looked at their cycles, three cycles prior to vaccination and 4 to 6 cycles post-vaccination. And what they found is that in participants who were vaccinated, their period came 0.5 days late after the second vaccine. And it was closer to 2 days late if both doses were given in the same cycle. And there was no changes to the actual bleeding days. And then the changes normalized in the next 1 to 2 cycles. So while the reported less than 1 day change in cycle length is statistically significant, it's really not clinically significant. And we know that a clinically significant change in cycle length is greater than 8 days. This study did not look at period heaviness or cramping, which we know people have reported anecdotally online. So the bottom line is menstrual changes are normal really in any given cycle. And this is why it's really difficult to tease out changes related to vaccination versus normal variation. That last study is the largest prospective study on the topic. And even that study found minimal impact on menstrual changes. So this is reassuring, and we need more studies, further well-designed prospective studies. I just say I applaud the researchers who actually took these concerns seriously and actually studied something that was coming up from women online.
I'm hoping I'm back on to fix what happened. I was charging my my AirPods in between because they ran out. So probably where we ended up here. So great question from Sergio about how do the adverse reactions from COVID versus influenza compare to pregnant women in terms of frequency and severity? Not sure, Dr. Fell, if you've seen anything in the literature in comparing both, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
I'm assuming that Sergio is referring to vaccine, right? COVID vaccine versus influenza vaccine. I'm going to make that assumption. I'll answer it on that basis. You wouldn't usually compare, you wouldn't usually compare sort of two different vaccines because every vaccine has its own profile of kind of the type of reactions that you might have after becoming vaccinated. So I don't know of anything that's directly compared those two vaccines in pregnant people, but within, if we talk about COVID vaccine and the types of the type, severity, and frequency of reactions side effects after becoming vaccinated that we see in pregnant people versus non-pregnant people, they're very similar, as I described at the beginning. And then it's the same for influenza as well, like the types of muscle soreness or maybe low-grade fever or something that people report sometimes after influenza vaccine, the frequency and severity of those types of reactions after vaccination in pregnant people isn't really different from non-pregnant people. So it's kind of the same sort of profile.
No, I think you're right because he specifically mentioned adverse reaction. I might just add that I haven't personally seen any literature like comparing COVID-19 outcomes and influenza. I do think that maybe we'll be able to have some of the variable, but I haven't come across that. But it sounds like that was it because there was a thank you. There's a question about having access to the slides. My understanding, this webinar is recorded and will be available on the Bourne website as all the other webinars that happen. So if anyone's interested, you can access it there. Oh, perfect. Anne has answered that as well. Any other questions or comments? There's a question about whether some of us have gone through the data and adverse reaction from the Pfizer documents that were released.
No, I haven't.
I haven't. I've peeked at little things here and there from what's been kind of floating around, but I haven't read through the details. I think we all have so much new information that we're tacking in, and I agree that it's important, but we also have to understand all the other clinical emergencies of a global pandemic that's been happening that affects some of the decision makings that we've had to do to protect our populations. So I think what's important I might comment on the Pfizer and what's going on there is that, initially this trial was not, prepared and initially recruiting pregnant individuals, but they are in a trial that is ongoing now. I get brief updates here and there because we had been interested in seeing if there could be Canadian sites, but they are rolling out in the UK and in the US and other countries. And I think that's important for our pregnant populations to have those trials, to be able to have those trials from the beginning as well, and to have that information continue. Of course, I think recruitment will be affected because so many have so much more information and want to be protected as well. In terms of the data and adverse reaction, I think a comment that Dr. Fell made, I think, is important is that everyone can react for many, many personal reasons. And when we look at that data, we have to be very careful when we're analyzing what a pharmaceutical company has to report in that and what it means and implies clinically and what is relevant.
So Doreen, I'm just looking at the time and I think we're just about out of time. So on behalf of Bourne, I would like to thank our presenters and our facilitator for their excellent work, both from a research perspective in learning about as much as we can about vaccination, COVID vaccination in pregnancy, but also the real world experience of what a clinician every day has to experience with their patients. And hopefully Tally's website and app will help clarify some of this. And we look forward to the ongoing studies that DeShane and the team are doing to be able to answer further questions about vaccination and pregnancy. So once again, the webinar is recorded. As soon as we get it all technically cleaned up and everything, we'll have that posted on the Bonner Ontario website. So thank you everybody for your participation. And we look forward to continuing the work and certainly thank all the people contributing data, whether they're, you know, vaccine people or hospital people or midwifery practice groups. Everything you're doing is important to help answer these questions. So thank you very much, everybody.